Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. In this episode, we're focusing on a range of different topics, including everything from USL TV ratings to a new commentator moving to Fox Sports for the World Cup coverage, as well as the Turkish Super League signing a new deal. And we have some discussion about the art of football commentary, so the art of soccer commentary. My name is Christopher Harris, and I'm pleased to announce that today we've got a special co-host. And his name is John Roeder. John has been a football commentator for many, many years. John, welcome to the show.
Hello there. It's very nice to be with you.
So, John, I know that for those who don't know, John is an established football commentator, has broadcast many, many games over the years, and also an avid listener to the World Soccer Talk podcast. Just to go through your bio a little bit, John. So since leaving the BBC to go freelance in 1994, a lot of listeners may have heard John's words, commentary for games. What are some of the games that kind of stand out to you, or some of the tournaments that listeners may recognize your voice from?
I do a lot of world feeds, as you intimated there, Chris. I've done, I think, 14 tournaments now for FIFA in various places around the world. It depends whether in the US you get those or not. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. Particularly in Canada, I know that you do via TSN and CBC and things like that. In terms of matches, the Women's World Cup final in 2015 in Vancouver. The whole match actually is available on the new FIFA Plus app, which is an amazing app. And that was probably as close to perfection as I ever got with a commentary. It was an amazing occasion. Other games that spring to mind immediately, Spain 3, Portugal 3 at the last World Cup in Russia. I was fortunate enough to be in Sochi. And the YouTube edited video of that, which is about 3 minutes highlights, that's had something like 95 million views on YouTube, which is incredible. But they're all in the past. The next game is always the most important. And it doesn't matter what level that game is. The next one is always the most important. I've done Match of the Day, the iconic BBC television programme since 2004. I've done plenty of European football for BT Sport here in the UK for the last 10 years since they were established. I've done basically every single channel that exists in the UK that covers sport.
Excellent. So we'll get more into that a little bit later. But one of the first questions that pops up for me, John, is in terms of commentary. Has it changed at all from the beginning when you first started out to now? Is it the same as it's always been? Any changes you've seen?
I think there has been a lot of changes, to be honest, Chris. I mean, the main one is that obviously you've got far more people doing it, both on a staff level for various broadcasters and also on a freelance level. When I went freelance from the BBC in 1994, there weren't very many people who could work for any channel that they wished. And now there are a lot more of them. I think the style has changed a lot as well. I think that is possibly due to the influence of the American way of broadcasting football. I'm sorry, I can't call it soccer, it's football. Insofar as there are a lot more stats used nowadays. Personally, I prefer to use a stat only if I would find it interesting. So, for example, the fact that somebody has scored 17 goals in 234 appearances, well, that's not really very interesting. If they've never scored in those 234 appearances, then that is interesting. Also, if they've scored 233 goals in those 234 appearances, that's interesting. But, you know, I think the use of stats more, I prefer not to use them unless I find them to be of interest. And also the role of the co-commentator. If you go back 20, 30 years, maybe or so, the co-commentator didn't say as much as they do now. And in a way, that's a good thing because most of us commentators have never played it at a really, really high level. And hopefully the co-commentator is giving us an insight into the game and how it's being played and giving us an insight into what we can't see. So we can all sort of say, oh, great cross, great header, great goal. But why? And that is the role of the co-commentator. And I think the co-commentator's role has become far more important in recent years.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I think in some ways the profile of a football commentator and co-commentator, in many ways, some of them are stars now. I mean, there's always been, you know, the Martin Tylers and Brian Moores and Barry Davis and those from, say, the 70s or 80s and thereafter. But in many ways, whether it's, I mean, John Champion being signed by ESPN to go to America, if it's Peter Drury recently being signed by NBC Sports, in previous years, Martin Tyler got signed by, I think, ABC to go to America, but then also went to Australia to do a World Cup. Do you think, in a way, though, do you agree with that? Do you think that the profile of a football commentator, that they've become more of the stars? Not, I mean, they're not football stars by any means, but in terms of more well-known?
Yes, having said that, I don't particularly care for it. I think a good commentator should be like a good referee, i.e. you shouldn't really notice them. They should be interesting. They should help the flow of the game. They should help the viewer. But I disagree completely with people who suddenly think they are the story because they are commentating on the game. Yeah, your well-known commentators. Peter's move to NBC obviously is a big one, both this side of the pond and on your side. But yeah, I really don't agree with commentators being stars. We're there to help the viewer and to aid the viewer. It's not about us. It really isn't. Because if we weren't there on the television, the game would still be broadcast. It would just have natural atmosphere on it. Far more important on the radio, of course, where if the commentator wasn't there, you wouldn't have anything. But no, I'm not particularly in favor of commentators becoming stars.
Yeah, definitely good points there. So speaking of football commentators, one piece of the news that came out this week, just actually this week, was that Jackie Oatley has been hired by Fox Sports to be one of their lead football commentators, soccer commentators for the 2022 World Cup starting in November, December. John, in terms of, I mean, so some of our listeners will know Jackie through some of the Premier League World Feed broadcasts. Some of them may know her from some of the radio broadcasts. But have you had a chance to work with her? What can you tell us about Jackie Oatley?
I've known Jackie for years. The football commentary community in the UK is reasonably small once you get to a certain level. I know Jackie for years. She's an excellent commentator and was a really good acquisition from Fox Sports. I think she'll be really good, and I think the US audience will enjoy her tremendously. Am I right in thinking, Chris, that apart from Derek Ray, who is kind of an adopted American anyway, will Jackie be the first non-US voice on Fox World Cup coverage?
I think it's
in terms of a main play-by-play commentator, and again, I hate that word play-by-play, but so, in terms of a main commentator?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going through the names in my head. I think for this World Cup, yeah, absolutely. For previous World Cups, they probably had a few people that they brought in, but it's rare. I mean, definitely Fox Sports, as you know, I'm sure, is mostly kind of all-American, and that's their focus, and they've really kind of played that up in terms of hiring different talents, both co-commentary, presenters, studio analysts, and the actual commentators. But yeah, I think you're right. So this is a departure for them in hiring somebody that's not American, and especially being one of the lead commentators, playing a really key role. It should be interesting, because I think she's going to bring a lot to it, definitely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jackie is a really, really good commentator. As I say, she's an excellent signing for Fox Sports. And it's also part of the welcome thing, where the diversity of the commentary team is being expanded again. So, again, it's a thoroughly positive move.
Yeah, and she has the experience too. I mean, she's been doing this for a number of years. For me personally, I mean, I probably am more familiar with her from radio commentaries, and she has a very authoritative voice, a very recognizable voice, and has done quite a few commentaries on television too, of course. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how she slots in with the World Cup, and also what type of assignments she gets, if she gets mostly, say, I don't know, England games, right? I mean, it could be that. Derek Ray, of course, being Scottish, and Scotland not being there. Derek's very cosmopolitan. I can see Derek especially doing the Germany games. He's a you mean definitely a germaphobe, germaphile in terms of that goes. Now, in addition to that, and this week there was some other news too that Turkey, the Turkish Super League, which is relatively a smaller league, but has signed a deal with beIN Sports for the next several years, actually next 2 years, a global deal. Those games will continue on in the United States on television there. In addition to that, too, we had a USL game this past weekend. We had Hartford Athletic against Louisville City, second division American soccer. And this game was on ESPN. So for the second week in a row, they've had a game on ESPN. This one had 142,000 viewers, which is a decent number for a second division American soccer league. Now, John, I'm sure that kind of not a massive number in terms of UK numbers, but for kind of a fledgling league, that's definitely a good sign there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the signing of the Turkish league is quite an interesting one, isn't it? Because obviously, America, when I've been there, and I've been fortunate enough to go on quite a few occasions, it's a very cosmopolitan country, isn't it? A lot of different mixes. I mean, when I did a Mexico game in America at the Copa America Centenario in 2016, it was like being in Mexico City. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. I do wonder how they're going to cover it, the Turkish league, in terms of commentary. Because I'm presuming that there wouldn't be a world feed available, and I'm guessing they're going to just concentrate on the big clubs, you know, your Fenerbahce's, your Galatasaray's and Besiktas's of this world.
Yeah, that's a good question, because previously, in previous seasons, that beIN Sports has had it for the United States. I think most of the games have been available on streaming only. So the games that were on television usually was their in-house commentators. And then I think for the streaming games, usually it would be I don't know if it would be that. That's a good question. I can't remember off the top of my head in terms of that. Going back to USL for a second too. So 142,000 viewers for that game on ESPN, and it's one of those things that that number was greater than the number for the Philadelphia Union game against New York City for Major League Soccer on Sunday night on FS1, and. ESPN right now is in talks with USL about extending the deal that they have in place. It expires this season. This gives USL a really good place to be in terms of saying, hey, there is actually interest in this league. We've had a couple of games so far. There's two more coming up on television. And these numbers are very similar to Major League Soccer. So it makes you wonder if no matter what soccer is played in those windows on ESPN on a weekend, it's comparative to Major League Soccer. And also at the same time then too, with MLS signing the deal with Apple for the next several years, for the next 10 years actually, for the streaming deal, ESPN is in discussions with MLS about the TV side of the things, the TV deal. And I wonder if the USL conversation will end up being discussed in the meeting rooms between ESPN and MLS, and ESPN might use this as leverage. It might say, hey, well, USL, I mean, a second division team is getting pretty close to MLS numbers, so maybe this could be part of the actual discussions or kind of the leverage that ESPN may have.
Yeah, there's one point here, Chris. Back in 1992 here in the UK, when the Premier League was established and it went on to subscription television, Sky Television, Channel 4 signed a very cheap deal to show Italian football from Serie A. And the Italian football was actually far more popular in terms of viewer numbers than the Premier League, because the Premier League was hidden behind a subscription. The Channel 4 Italian was free to air. So I wonder if that might come into play in a similar scenario. The other thing that, as a member of the commentators union, is obviously there are all the local TV commentators, like my good friend Tony Husband, who works for Nashville.
Yep.
Do we know what is going to be happening with those people as yet? I mean, are they all going to be out of a job come the end of this season?
Yeah, technically right now, yes, unless they're hired by Major League Soccer for next season. So MLS, from what I understand, is planning on hiring basically about a dozen commentating teams. And we'll go ahead and go through kind of the roster of who's available. And then we'll look at maybe some other talent that might be available and then pick kind of the 12 or so teams to go ahead and do the commentary. Some of that's going to be on site at matches. A lot of it, about half of it, is going to be called off the tube or off the monitor in a kind of a centralized production place in a studio. So with people like Tony and others that are a lot of kind of English announcers that have come to the United States to go ahead and commentate games for Major League Soccer, they may find themselves with MLS and the Apple deal in 2023 onwards, or they may find themselves basically kind of cut out and not in there, and may have to then look at other options. But yeah, that's a good point, John, because it's really kind of right now up in the air, and they've got this season to finish off, but I'm sure they're having some discussions, hopefully with their agents or directly with MLS to try to figure out a way to get on there. I mean, and Tony, and there's many others too, that are really, really, some really great commentary. We've got Lloyd Sam, who's a co-commentator at Charlotte, Nigel Riococca, who's doing some great work throughout the United States, doing a lot of Copa Libertadores games for beIN Sports. So there's a lot of opportunities for a lot of newer, fresher faces, but also some kind of veteran ones to actually continue with Major League Soccer, and I hope they do.
This is the life, actually, of a football commentator, which people might not appreciate, but basically contracts come and contracts go. And you basically have to try and go with the contracts and hope that somebody will pick you up as a person to work on those deals. I mean, the reason, if you look at my website, johnroeder.com, the reason I have so many clients, both present and past, is literally because contracts come and contracts go. So, you know, I mentioned Channel 4 Italian earlier. I did that for a few years, and then they lost the rights to that. So you move on. And I think, to be honest, that's how I've made a career out of being a squad member, if you like to call it that. Somebody who's not the number one commentator at any network or on any program, but they all broadcasters will always need somebody else to come in and do the secondary game of the weekend or the third game of the weekend. And that's the way that I've made my living, which is possibly why when you said earlier about star commentators, I don't particularly care for that at all. I would call myself a jobbing, working commentator as opposed to a star commentator. I would reject that totally.
Yeah, that's a good point too, because I know Derek Ray and others I've spoken with in the past have said that they much prefer the life of a freelance commentator, where they can basically go through and kind of pick and choose who they want to work with, have a little bit more flexibility rather than being not stuck, but basically kind of with a contract with a certain broadcaster and not having the flexibility. And someone like Derek, yourself, John, I'm sure, and others have been able to kind of really benefit from that freelance approach where you can pick and choose sometimes or look around and not be just held to a contract with one broadcaster.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything, isn't it? I mean, if you have a contract with somebody, at least you know that you're going to get paid every month. As a freelance, I mean, I look at my diary, it's completely empty at the moment. Completely empty. My first booking is not until the end of the year.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though, too, because it is that's the other part of it. It's like risk and rewards. So sometimes, yeah, right, it could be one of those things that during great years, it's wonderful. But then there's always going to be, I mean, there's always football matches on, but sometimes there are going to be spaces of time where there's, you mean, it's almost like a writer, right? It's almost like kind of a professional writer where you're writing books, yeah, but sometimes you might be in between books and then you're kind of waiting until the next check comes through.
Yeah, and I hasten to add that is because the Premier League matches haven't been allocated for Match of the Day yet, if I'm back on the team. Again, this is another thing of being a freelance. You don't quite ever know if you're going to be asked back again. It's like anything, isn't it? If you're a painter and decorator, if somebody asks you to come round and paint their lounge or their kitchen or whatever, if they then ask you back 6 months later to come and do another room in the house, you know that they're happy with what you've done. And it's exactly the same with football commentary. Once you get the second booking and the third booking, you know you're okay.
what criteria do you think they use? I mean, do they have a method in terms of kind of making those selections?
I have absolutely no idea about that, Chris. I'm just very grateful that clients basically seem to want to keep booking me again and again. I think, basically, if you do a good job, you've done your research, you sound good on air, you don't require mothering, nannying, you're not a diva, In other words, you turn up, you do your job, and you go home again. And I think that's all you can do, really. You just do the job to the best of your ability, which is why I say that the next game is always the most important. You know, you might be doing a huge match in 10 days' time, but if you've got two games before that, those two games are the most important. Not that huge match that's coming up, those two games that are coming up before that.
And then from your experience, I mean, most of the commentary gigs that you do get, are they mostly solo commentary or combined with a co-commentator?
A mixture of both, to be honest, Chris. It's quite interesting because when you do a solo commentary, you're kind of trying to be the analyst as well. But you don't come from that position of actually having played the game at the very highest level. Whereas an analyst or a co-coms will actually give you that, hopefully, will give you that insight. Some of the best co-commentators that I have worked with and have the pleasure of working with weren't the biggest names as players. People like Stuart Robson, Tony DiRigo, Andy Hinchcliffe. You know, they're not the big household names that are known the world over, but they have learnt a new trade. They have learnt the art of co-commentary, and they have learnt the art of being able to explain what is happening to the viewer and also being able to say, look at this. This is what happens when that happens on that side. Say, you know, look at the run of the left back here on the left side of your screen. And that releases the space in the middle for the midfielder to run into. And three defenders have gone, which means that the forward comes in on the far side, which to me is telling me something that I can't necessarily know, but I can see it now because they've pointed it out to me, rather than great header, great cross, great goal, that sort of thing.
We recently, just within the last couple of weeks, got to hear a brand new co-commentator, Paul Robinson, who did a lot of the games for, and actually all of the England games on the World feed with Peter Drury for the UEFA Nations League. Now, the matches themselves and the scorelines were not what England fans wanted, but for somebody like Paul Robinson or someone similar, I mean, how do they get into the business? I mean, is there a process where sometimes they may have to actually do kind of a trial, do some commentaries of games that may not be broadcast?
To be honest with you, Chris, I actually have no idea. I think a lot of these people have an agent, and the agent will try and get them some media work. What I do think is that somebody like Paul, I didn't actually hear any of those because I was actually working on the same nights. But somebody like him, who is a natural communicator, a natural broadcaster, will work at it. If you think about it, if you're a professional football player, you go into training 4 or 5 times a week and you practice your art, don't you? Mm-hmm. Now, once you've retired, it's not easy actually to talk on the television with insight about the game that you've done almost by instinct for 15, 20 years or so.
Yep.
So the best of them will work on it, and they will ask for advice. I mean, Andy Hinchcliffe is a perfect example of that. He is a man who has never stopped learning about television. And all these ex-players that come into TV, they're used to receiving instructions. They're used to a coach coaching them. They're used to carrying out those instructions. And I find it a little perplexing that sometimes it is assumed that because somebody has played a sport at a high level, that they can talk about that sport at a high level and communicate what they know to Mr. and Mrs. Public. Mm-hmm. And I think what Andy Hinchcliffe has done in particular is to absorb a lot of knowledge from commentators and from co-commentators as to what is required, you know, so that you get away from the great cross, great header, great goal thing, and you actually explain why something is happening. And I think that's going back to what we said earlier, I think that's one of the big advances in recent years, that co-commentators have become far better broadcasters.
Yeah, definitely. And it's one of those things, like each week on the website, on worldsoccertalk.com, we publish the listings of who the commentators are going to be for the Premier League games. And oftentimes, through the course of a season, there's a lot of fresh new names coming through on the co-commentary, and some names that have come back. Sometimes it's football commentators that, such as Alan Parry, did some games in the last couple of seasons, and other names. It's almost on a constant rotation, except for the ones that are the ones that you can almost guarantee will be the first name on paper. And it's interesting listening to the different commentary styles, whether it's the commentator himself or herself and the co-commentary, and how they are so different. I mean, Gary Bertles is always the one that always comes up as somebody that I respect as a player. I respect as a co-commentator too, because he doesn't hold back. He gives it his all. He's a little bit overly critical, overly negative. But that's who he is. That's why we love him, in terms of him kind of analyzing, you mean, a scoring situation and a player making a mistake and kind of saying, like, yeah, this is what he should have done. But that, I think that's, yeah, at the end of the day, that's what we love about commentators and co-commentators, is we get to know them kind of intimately through the games.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. On the pod last week, or maybe it might have been the week before, Chris, I think one of the listeners had written in to sort of say, UK commentary can sometimes be a bit funereal. Am I getting
that's
right with that?
That's right.
Now, having been in the States quite a bit, you know, if you think about commentary as something like the Richter scale, so you can go up to 10, okay? For me, if you start off at 8 out of 10, where are you going to go if something absolutely extraordinary goes? Mm-hmm. Every goal is not a world-beating goal. It's not Spinal Tap. You can't go up to 11. And if somebody hasn't seen Spinal Tap, I thoroughly recommend it. Each game can be exciting, but each game can also be actually, frankly, quite dull. Mm-hmm. You know, you shouldn't be selling every game as though it is the greatest thing since sliced bread, because sometimes they're not. And the other thing, you know, the South American style is the South American style. The European style is the European style. And maybe what viewers in the US are getting used to is a kind of a homogenization of it all. Yep. So you've got a bit of South American, a bit of European, and a bit of American. But yeah, I disagreed with European commentary, UK commentary being funereal. I disagreed with that vehemently, I must say.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on what you're brought up on or what you're used to. So if somebody's brought up in the UK listening to BBC Radio or Talk Sport these days, listening to that type of commentary and just the style of commentary versus South American football, which is, I mean, two extremes, I mean, completely different. And the American commentary, for the most part, I think is still trying to find its voice. It's still trying to find out what that is, because it's not British commentary. It's not South American commentary. It may be a hybrid of the two together, or it might be partly more about American sports, which is a lot of the American sports are filled with stats. And sometimes, yeah, I agree, John. Sometimes it is one of those things that, for me personally, it can almost be a little bit, if it's a dull game and the commentary is at an 8 out of 10, what I see does not match what I hear. And there's a disconnect. And then sometimes I find myself, my eyes wander and I start, on my phone or something like that. And I'm like, okay, I'm not really interested in this game as much now because this person's overselling it. It's rare that you'll have a commentator undersell a game, but what I do like is those peaks and valleys where it is something where it can be, kind of a dry spell during a game, and then all of a sudden the action just goes ballistic and the commentary matches that too. And to me, at the end of the day, and I've been talking about this for years and years, I think there is an art to commentary. There's an art to football commentary in terms of the way it's done. And just like with regular art anywhere in the world, there's lots of different styles and there are hybrids. And it is interesting, I think, for the viewers and listeners. They probably pick and choose the style that's more like them.
Yeah, I mean, when I've been in America and watched soccer on American TV, I just think, stop talking. Please stop talking for a while and stop bombarding with statistics, which, again, is the American thing. But it goes back to what Barry Davis said, and I'll paraphrase it, because he basically said, one person's favorite commentator is another person's pain in the backside. that's it.
That's so true, yeah. speaking of commentary, John, I know you've had a lot of experience doing the World Feed, and this is a topic that's come up several times, probably in the last few months at least. about the world feed, and sometimes for listeners or for readers of the site, they might be a little bit confused sometimes about the world feed and what it is and how it works. Could you shine some light? Because I know you're one of the top football commentators for the world feeds for football in general, for soccer in general. But I was wondering if you can give us some insight.
Yeah, first of all, Chris, the world feed is not a simulcast. So it is not the domestic TV broadcast that's just pumped out around the world. For example, here in the UK, we get the A-League from Australia on BT Sport, and we get the Australian commentary. And that is basically going out in Australia, and it's just pumped out to the rest of the world. So we might get an advert going, you know, don't forget there's rugby union coming up with the Wallabies against the All Blacks. That's Saturday at 5 o'clock or whatever. That has no relevance to a UK audience whatsoever. A world feed is specifically, as the name entails, for the world. It should be strictly neutral. It should be for all TV markets. And a world feed, English language commentary, and there are world feed Spanish language commentaries as well, should be, as I say, straight down the middle. I'll take you through how a world feed works from the start of the broadcast. And I'll do it from, say, the UEFA Nations League, which we've just finished doing. But I'll start by saying the EFL that's on ESPN Plus, I believe, in the US.
That's right, yep.
That starts 5 minutes before kickoff. So you run the titles, and then the world feed commentator will pick up and say, you know, hello to you, welcome to Swansea. And it's Swansea City against Norwich City in the English Premier, in the English EFL Championship. You know, let's have a look at the table. Swansea are top, Norwich are fifth. Blah, blah, blah. Let's have a look at the teams. Here we go. And that's quite simple because that's 5 minutes beforehand. There's a wrap-up at halftime, which goes to the graphic. It's usually about 30 seconds. You pick up again for the start of the second half. Again, at the end of the match, you wrap up the game to match the graphic, you know, full-time. I'll say this for you, Swansea. Swansea 5, Norwich 0, say, just for you, Chris.
Thank you.
And then they run the titles again, and that's gone. Okay, now let me just try and experiment with you, Chris. If I take you through how a UEFA Nations League game broadcast will start, I'd like you to, and in fact anybody who's listening can do this as well, I'd like you to just think of different points in this running order that broadcasters around the world might be joining the broadcast if they are taking the world feed English language commentary. Okay, so you're about 10, 12 minutes before kickoff. Titles are run. Or there's a wide shot. Mm-hmm. And then you get the ident graphic with, I don't know, let's say it's Germany against the Netherlands. The commentator will pick up and go, you know, hello, we're in the Amsterdam Arena. It's the Netherlands against Germany in group A1 of the UEFA Nations League. You know, a big match, plenty of history behind it. Then there'll be a graphic up with the results so far in the group. So you talk about that, then the group standing, you know, the Netherlands are on 4 points, Germany are on 4 points, Croatia are on 1 point or whatever it might be. Then the shot will change to the teams in the tunnel. So you'll see them milling about, the referee will be there, a bit of talking about the setup. Then the teams will walk from the tunnel onto the pitch. You'll see them line up on the pitch and you'll say all the team news in a moment after the two respective national anthems. National anthems. Okay. One, two. Then it's so let's have a look at the teams for you. Then here's team A. Here's the Netherlands. Three changes from last time. Then we'll go to the referee who will do the toss with the two captains. There might even be a microphone shoved in there, in which case we'll be able to hear the audio. Then we'll do the second team. Here's the German team. It's the same team that beat Croatia 3-0 on Saturday. Then we'll have a graphic of the substitutes. Then we might get a shot of the two coaches. Then we might get a shot of two key players. And then we'll be ready for kickoff. And then the game kicks off and we're underway. How many different starting points do you think there are in that little running order, Chris?
It's interesting too. I'd say about five, but what happens, I mean, so like, for example, I know like Fox Sports will come in probably right before the whistle blows. So basically 5 seconds before ESPN probably would start. If it's ESPN Plus, would start as soon as the graphic comes up, kind of that wide graphic. before it mentions the team names. Other broadcasters might come in right after the national anthem. Some might come in right before. So I'd say roughly five.
Yeah, you're about right. There's basically, as you say, taking the whole thing. The team's walking. You always have a pause when the teams walk out of the tunnel, or at least you should do. And as they cross the touchline, you pick it up again. There's usually that shot, isn't there, of the ball on a plinth.
Yep.
And the ref picks it up. So as soon as the ref has picked it up and the first players walk past the ball, that's another start point. Off the back of the national anthems is definitely one. I mean, I remember when I was in Canada for the Women's World Cup a few years ago, TSN, who took the world feed for pretty much all the games except the Canada ones, would say, you know, after the national anthems, we'll be on the call with John Roder or whatever, whoever it was. So that was a nice clean one for them.
Sure.
And then you've got the kickoff as well. And each time, as a world feed commentator, you've got to start it again, but in a different way. So that those viewers who have been with you since the start don't feel that you're repeating yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to watch out for, and I don't know whether anybody listening has noticed this, but when you get the kickoff of a game like that, you will get a view from camera one, which is the whole pitch. And at the bottom of your screen, you'll see the touchline and you'll see a man or a woman there, usually with their right arm outstretched at 90 degrees.
Yep.
Yeah, does that sound familiar?
Yeah, the match official.
It's either the match manager, or the floor manager or whatever. When that arm goes out, it's usually 10 seconds to kick off because you can't kick off early. Say the match is scheduled to kick off at 8 p.m. local time, it cannot kick off at 7:59:49. It cannot do that. It simply cannot do that. So the match manager will stand there with their arms outraised. And as the world feed commentator, you know that you have to shut up then because you will, like you said, there will be clients joining specifically for kickoff.
Right.
So you want a nice clean in for that. And then at halftime, you talk to the graphic, which will say, you know, Netherlands won, Germany won, and you do the same at full time. And that's how a world feed works, because you have clients joining all the time and you actually don't know where those clients are most of the time. So you shouldn't ever say anything like good evening from the Amsterdam Arena.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the time difference between you and I. That's 5 hours. But the time difference between, say, Amsterdam and Australia is a lot different. It could be morning there.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because I mean, it's one of those things that which is enlightening, John, because it is something that there's a science to it, there's a formula to it. Is this something that has been going on for a long, long time, or is this something that was developed, say, I don't know, Sky Sports in the early 90s?
No, certainly not Sky Sports. It's evolved over the years, particularly with coverage of FIFA tournaments, World Cup tournaments, and it's basically been adopted for the UEFA World Feed as well, for the Champions League World Feed. You'll basically have a set running order. But if you're doing the World Feed, again, you have to be, as a commentator, you have to be neutral. So, for example, in Russia at the last World Cup, I did England beating, actually, I can't remember who they beat. They beat somebody 6-1.
Mm-hmm.
And as an Englishman, I'm thrilled with that. That's great. That's really good. But England on that day, I can't remember whether they played in white or red, but they were the team in white or red. They weren't England. They weren't the team that I support. I'm going straight down the middle because there could be people all around the world who are not supporting England. If I was doing that game for ITV or the BBC in England, then of course I'm going to be partisan because the majority of my viewers will be supporting England.
Mm-hmm.
But around the world, there could be people who are neutral, who support the opposition. You know, I mean, a lot of the world feeds will go across Africa and the Middle East. And so if you're doing England against, say, Ghana, you'll actually be on Ghanaian television. So if you're partisan towards England, that's not going to go down very well at all, is it? So you have to be neutral on the world feed.
Yep.
Totally, totally neutral.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting too, because like sometimes though, like especially the UEFA broadcasts in terms of say the Champions League, and this is a good example, is that when there are games on, and it might be for what we know is the world feed, but the world feeds may have many of them maybe English or British announcers. So you can go down the list. There's so many of them on the world feed, But however, sometimes if it's, I don't know, Liverpool against whoever it may be, even though I think viewers here in the United States are hoping and expecting kind of that unbiased, straight down the middle, kind of neutral commentary, it's often whatever the co-commentator says or whatever the commentator says, you can tell there's definitely an understanding that they know more about the team from the England side, and there's almost like a sense of disappointment in their voices and then in their tone if the British side or the Premier League side loses in that UEFA Champions League game. I think in a way
to be honest, Chris, if I was producing that, I would have a word. I mean, I'm rather loath to ever criticise any of my fellow brethren who do commentary, but I would definitely have a word. That to me is not acceptable.
Yeah, and I agree too. And I think it's one of those things that yes, I might be hoping that Liverpool wins that game, but I'm just a fan of British descent, hoping that they win. But it does. You mean oftentimes it has happened where it feels unfair, unbalanced. And for me, I would much prefer to have somebody straight down the middle, kind of giving us some insight on both sides and trying to be as fair. It's got to be difficult, though, John, right? I mean, it is. I mean, inherent, you're an Englishman. It's got to be difficult sometimes to try to strike that balance.
No, it shouldn't be. This is where your professionalism should come into play. You are doing a job for the world. As I mentioned, if you're doing it for ITV or for BBC, then fine. Yeah, be partisan towards your team. But yep. If you're doing it for the world, absolutely, absolutely not. You can have a little fist bump or something like that if England do score, but your voice and your words should not reflect the fact that you are English.
What I find interesting too, just as one additional thought on this one, is that oftentimes in my conversations with different commentators or co-commentators, I'll give a couple of examples, Peter Drury and Jim Beglin, is oftentimes they don't know that they're doing the world feed, but they don't know if in the United States, as one example, if their commentary is being used or if they're using, say, Fox Sports' commentary with their own announcers. Would social media be the only way, really, you mean, to find out? You mean, kind of, if you're doing a world feed, which countries are, you mean, if they share feedback, which countries are listening in?
Does it really matter, Chris? Does it actually really matter?
Yeah, that's true.
Because your commentary's going out, it could be used anywhere. I'll give you an example. In the World Cup in 2014, my wife and youngest daughter were on holiday in Mauritius. While I was in Brazil, and they went downstairs to the restaurant cum bar in the hotel they were staying at, and my youngest said to my wife, "Mum, do you recognise the voice on the TV that's doing the football?" She went, "No," and my youngest went, "Well, you should do. You're married to him." You know, so it could be going anywhere. You could be going on a huge market like in beIN Sports in the Middle East. You could be going right across Africa. You could be going to small places like Mauritius or Malta TV or Falkland Islands TV. Mm-hmm. You know, all those services are taking your world feed commentary, and all should expect and be delivered the high standard that you should be setting yourselves.
All right. Well, speaking of high standards, Gareth Bale has made a move from Real Madrid. I mean, was on a free available, but went to LAFC this week. So that was big news in Major League Soccer. Signed a big deal for 12 months there. Possibility of longer than that. What's your take on the Gareth Bale story? Was it big news in the UK?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was big news. I mean, as I understand it, LAFC are doing well. He has to be fit for the World Cup. MLS goes until October, then you've got the playoffs and the MLS Cup final. If they get to that, that all finishes in early November. Absolutely perfect for him, isn't it? I mean, I think on a recent podcast, Chris, you or Kartik said that MLS really did need a marquee signing. Giorgio Chiellini has also joined LAFC.
Yep.
Are they marquee signings?
I think Gareth Bale is. So I think, and this is hard too, because I'm also Welsh, born in Wales. You mean, so I have a little bit of a bias here. But even if I didn't have the bias, I think Gareth Bale's the type of person that people would want to go and buy tickets to go see him play if he came to your local city. And also on television too. I think there's a lot of curiosity in terms of how will he do in Major League Soccer in terms of his level. He's certainly an exciting player to watch. And then beyond that, I think the big story really is that with Gareth Bale being captain of Wales and the first match in the World Cup in 2022 for the United States is going to be the United States against Wales coming up against Gareth Bale. So I think there's that part of it in terms of what Major League Soccer did and making the decision to sign him makes sense, because I think he is going to move that needle maybe a little bit, maybe more than that. A lot of it depends on his playing time and being injury free and how exciting what he brings to the game. So I think it's a good fit for MLS. I think it's a good fit for Gareth Bale too, in terms of being getting more playing time, probably being one of the first names on a team sheet if he wants to be, as well as growing his brand, but also more importantly, getting that playing time and playing in some really warm conditions, as opposed to playing, say, in Cardiff, where that was the that was the talk a couple of weeks ago that maybe he'd be playing for Cardiff in the Championship. So. Yeah, no, I think it's a smart move. And also for Major League Soccer, too, with it being a one-year deal, with the option to lengthen that, too, if they want to, it does make it more interesting. I think more likely that people might sign up for Apple TV in the beginning next year to watch these games. And with Apple TV, I'm sure they'll show a lot of the games for free in the beginning. But it's a great way. He's the type of player that... You mean he's a professional athlete? He's somebody that I think has a lot of people have respect for him. I think he's an exciting player. I'm really interested and excited about this one.
Yeah, I think it's a very good signing.
I really appreciate you coming on the show. This is really insightful in terms of giving us an idea of life as a football commentator, especially on the World Feed too, because here in the United States, we get to hear the World Feed probably more than a lot of other countries kind of. So on, and especially with a lot of the games being on streaming these days. And I think that's where things are heading. They're already there, is that we're getting more and more of the World Feeds as opposed to domestic broadcasters using their own talent to call the games, partly because there's so many games. I mean, like, for example, I think ESPN Plus has over 2,500 games a year. I mean, from around the world, just soccer games. Paramount Plus, which is the CBS Sports' streaming service, that has more than 1,000 soccer games from around the world. And those are just two streaming services, and there's several others. So I think in many ways, we might get a chance to hear people like you, John, and many others on the World Feed probably a lot more in the future.
Yeah. I mean, it's always an interesting thing. I mean, I will say in conclusion, Chris, that I am a very, very lucky person to be doing this as a job, as a so-called career. To watch football for a living is absolutely fantastic. And it's something that, you know, a lot of young kids will dream of. And I've been lucky enough to actually live that dream. Can I just plug my Twitter feed, which is johnroder.com. johnroder.com, and then you can link through to my website. But if anybody's got any questions, there is an email address on my website, and you can just send me a question. I'll be happy to answer it if I can.
Yeah, and John's website again is johnroder.com. And John, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I really, really appreciate it. And it's been a great conversation. So thank you.
I've enjoyed it greatly, Chris. Hopefully, we'll talk again sometime.
Okay, so let's move on to listener mailbag. First up is Chris talking about the K-League from Korea. I recently watched a South Korean league game between Suwon and Seoul FC on the league's free streaming service, and I have to say that the production values were good. For some unknown reason, commentary was not available, but there was crowd noise. Even with the stadium at 40% capacity, the atmosphere was electric. The level of play is about equal to both MLS and EFL League One, although there are less fouls. Definitely we'll be watching more of these matches before the Premier League season begins. Then we have Nick talking about comparison between American sports and European sports. I think actually, Nick, we're going to save that one for next week with Kartik, because I definitely want to get his insights on that. Next up, we talk to, let's see who we have next. Next, we have Gustavo. And Gustavo is talking about soccer cities in the United States. He says, "Hi, guys. I really enjoy your show and usually listen during my Saturday morning jog. I was shocked last week to hear Kartik, who I respect very much, say that London was not a soccer town. This is incredible to hear from somebody so worldly like Kartik. The London metropolitan area has 29 professional soccer clubs in the different divisions and will have 7 clubs in the biggest, richest league in the world, which is the Premier League next season, each with its own stadium. I would say that London is not only a soccer town, it is the greatest soccer town in the world. It seems that every male Londoner supports a football team, and now more and more women are becoming supporters, as in most places in the globe as well. Soccer is so far ahead of second place that no one really knows what the second most popular sport is in London, or in England for that matter." So listeners, if you do have any questions, feedback, or any topics you'd like us to discuss, definitely get in touch with us. You can reach out to us via the website, worldsoccertalk.com, and then in the podcast section, we've got a section there that you can leave comments. You can email us through web@worldsoccertalk.com. You can reach us through Twitter, @worldsoccertalk, and on Facebook, which is facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. All right, guys, thank you for listening. We really appreciate you tuning in to this episode. On behalf of everyone here at World Soccer Talk, we wish you a happy 4th of July, and we'll be back soon. Enjoy your football.